Welcome to the Michelle Meow Show, your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. Here at the Commonwealth Club on Thursdays, we do a special taping and with my co-host, John Zipper of the Commonwealth Club.
Hey, Michelle, welcome back.
Well, thanks to the Commonwealth Club for having us. I think this is a great space to include LGBTQ thought leaders. And today we have a wonderful, wonderful guest, an inspiration, a courageous man. He's a former Iraq War translator. He's a father, immigrant, or could be refugee. I'll ask him about that later in terms of status. Survivor, activist, so many identities that we can tack on there. So very, very honored to have Ghazwan Al-Sharif here with us. He is the subject of the film From Baghdad to the Bay. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor for me to be here.
Yeah, yeah. I said to you before we started the program, it's really hard to believe that this film is a little over an hour because of all the experiences and the stories that you tell about yourself. While we normally start the show off with a coming out story, I'm going to save that for later. However, we can start by talking about, you know, just you and where you grew up and what childhood was like, you know, as young Ghazwan.
Sure. I mean, yes, my name is Ghazwan Al-Sharif, but I go by G.
G.
To make life easier. Born in Baghdad, Iraq. And then my family are diplomat, so I traveled with my parents, luckily, around Europe and grew in London for over 6 years, and then went back to Iraq. Yeah, I was with the Iraq-Iran war that ended up for 10 years. The United Nations sanctions to Iraq as well. I saw and lived that, and now I'm here.
You do touch on coming out in a couple of ways in the film, but for many of us in the LGBTQ community, there's a moment where we know within ourselves that we're different, or we're special, yeah. Or, you know, things just don't connect the same way in the straight world, if you know what I mean. So yeah. For you and growing up in your childhood, you know, when was that moment in which you, that sparkle?
Yes, when I first saw a Barbie doll. I love playing with Barbies, and I love dressing up and just... Yeah.
Then, yeah, that we got it. Enough said. That speaks for itself. John.
Well, what Barbie dolls, how old are we talking, like 10 or younger or older?
Yeah, I'm talking about 10 first when I lived in the United Kingdom.
Okay.
And that's my big opportunity to introduce by Barbie.
So you were born in Baghdad. You lived most of your life there before the last 10 years, but you did travel out and around. Mm-hmm. If the Iraq war had not happened, the U.S. invasion and overthrow of Hussein, do you think you would still live there? Or do you think you would, if you were there, do you think you would want to move out?
You know, sometimes you think about it, you know, bad things can be good for you. Mm-hmm. Yeah, this war actually came with me, not against me, for a couple of things, which is right now why I'm here. Absolutely, I was not thinking to stay in Iraq, but it was not easy to just leave the country and go, especially with the sanctions.
Yeah.
And being an Iraqi was a big no-no. So, yeah.
Yeah. In the film, it starts out, you know, very strongly, you talk about knowing and having the courage and the belief that supporting and joining, you know, the U.S. military as a translator was the right thing to do, or it felt like you were doing something great or positive.
If I could, or at least add something into that, you had a line in there where I think you talked about it, sort of a liberation of yourself.
Correct.
Not just of the country. Could you?
Yes, this is a great question. In the beginning of 2003, when the war happened, the media, the propaganda was super strong against not just the regime. Yes, the people were in Iraq was too tired of the sanctions. We were too tired of the corruption. We were too tired of not being free even in our home, our room. So collapsed, the regime collapsed by days. Didn't took that long. Even the U.S. Army was surprised that they didn't have any real war. Mm-hmm. When they arrived to Tikrit, everyone dropped their weapons and surrendered easily like that. When I saw the soldiers, for me, it was my angels in here. They gave freedom for me. But that was a few days. And then after that, everything collapsed. Worse and worse. Looters. The whole country just collapsed. We didn't have police. We didn't have government. Who was controlling this? The whole country was actually the soldier, the American soldier. So in here, that's another story to talk about. But they didn't have any real education of what's the culture, what to do, what's the right, what's the wrong. Just let them do whatever it was. So it was chaotic. And then everything turns against them.
So the chaos, the violence, and then you mentioned, you know, things went downhill very, very fast. Mm-hmm. And even threats and violence imposed on you personally and your family. Did it ever feel like you changed your mind, that you wanted to get out, you wanted to not do this? And I know that your family had asked you to not. Right?
Yeah. Well, I'm a guy who have guts. I never give up. And I do believe in improving, educating. And I saw that gap. That's why I started giving lectures for the Army. That's why I tried to, you know, talk about the culture, what's the right thing, what's the right. And I've done it a couple of times. Yes, I got threats to quit, bombing, you name it, over 9 times. My parents disowned me for their life. But no, I truly believed in improving things, which worked perfectly.
When you were working with the U.S. troops, and what exactly were you doing? You said, you know, giving some lectures and things, but also as a translator, we kind of imagine you literally there with, you know, U.S. troops and Iraqis, and you translating between the two of them. Is that what it was, or were you doing like documents? Or
yes, I was the translator for the commanders.
Okay.
For the 4th Infantry Division, 1st Infantry Division, and the 28th Infantry Division. That was the last one. For the Engineer Brigade. Before the Army arrived, it was CPA, Coalition Provisional Authority. I was a translator for them over there as well. But because I'm the local guy from Tikrit, and I'm not talking about in Baghdad or the capital. I'm talking about Tikrit because that's where I worked and that's where I lived. Mm-hmm. So I'm the guy who knows the faces and know the majority of the people over there.
In the documentary, you were known as Tex?
Yes, my nickname, because they want to keep my identity, and then I do cover my face. My nickname is in Tex, as in Texas, the 4th Infantry Division. They are the first army. They couldn't pronounce my name, obviously.
But, you know, there was a line there or a quote where someone said that you were someone from the military, an American military, said you were one of the best, and you'll know it because you'll show up in, is it a cowboy? Was it a cowboy hat? Was that your signature thing?
Yeah, well, it's hot over there, you know. So I wear a cowboy hat, and then Colonel Nicholson, he's the first guy who gave me that nickname, Tex, T-E-X, which I still have the tag, by the way. So works perfectly. Everyone called me Tex over there.
Yeah, I was asking that question. I was wondering kind of what your feelings or thoughts were before the invasion about American culture, and then, you know, working with the military, the American military, what you picked up from that, and then what your impression of, you know, Americans were while throughout this entire process.
Well, once again, I was the lucky one who traveled Europe and London, raised in London. So I have a kind of idea. And then...
That's right. You knew Barbie.
My Barbie, exactly.
I don't think Barbie was international at that time.
America's great. It created Barbie.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Pretty much was our height.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's been kind of downhill since Barbie. Well, let's get into some of the darkest parts of this. One day, something happened, and you were taken away. Tell us about that. And I know this is
an
interesting section.
So, of course, in the documentary, it doesn't tell you the whole details because it's a documentary. We can't just keep it, you know, forever. But one day, while I was working for the CPA, Coalition Provisional Authority, and I sometimes I stay in the compound, and sometimes I go back to the house. But when I got the threats, they blow my house. So the American Army says, you know, you have to stay. You cannot go and either choose to quit and stay safe back home or live here in the base. So I said, no, I'm not a quitter. I'm not going to quit. I'm going to live here. Stay with in the base. So one day, the military police MP asked, they came to the building where I work, and they asked for me, and I came, and they said, Colonel Hickey wants you. I was like, okay. So in here, you know, I have a lot of things. This is a funny thing and sad. I was excited because I had helped a couple of you know, names and interrogation. And so I was like, I'm going to get a coin or something, certificate. And then it was in the Humvee. They went. It's getting darker. Took them about an hour, maybe longer. And then a guy came and says, put your hands back. And I did. And I still, you know, it's like, okay, you know, it's a surprise. Put a handcuff, and he says, say cheese, and I smile. And he says, are you beep kidding me? I can say
F words.
Yes, great. Are you kidding me? And I said, wow, that was rude. So I didn't smile, took another picture, put a bag, a stack, did I say it right?
A sack
on my head, put me back, and then cars drove about an hour. It was getting colder. Drips of, that was in December. Rain, you know, not a lot, but, you know, it's raining, it was colder. And then it's going a road about another hour. But, you know, this is my city, so I'm tracking where I'm going. But then suddenly, this is a desert. Mm-hmm. I'm going in a desert. And then took the sack, and I walked, and I just saw a big, huge guy. Now, I'm 6 foot tall. Imagine how tall is that guy. And then one of the guys went and whispered, came back. I'm still, they're still handcuffed in back. And I was not standing, I was on my knees. And it was super dark. And I looked at this guy and says, excuse me, sir, why am I here? He says, you don't know why you're here? Shut the up. This guy speaks English. I said, yeah, I'm a translator. I work for you guys. Humiliate me, put my head on the, you know, and starting searching me, taking my belt, taking my even...
shoelaces.
Watch everything I own. And then throw me in a 3-foot square. Remember, I just said it, I'm 6 foot. 3-foot square cell. And that cell used to be an oriental toilet, if you know what's an oriental toilet, you know.
Hole on the floor.
It was a hole in the, it's a toilet, so, but they put a pivot, that's it. Handcuffs and foot cuffs, not just handcuffs. Now, this is obviously illegal anywhere because you cannot put a detained person in jail while hanging, you know, if he's out, yes, but, and life go on. This is another story I can tell it for, but that continued for 75 days. Every day is a story. So I'm not going to tell you guys for now because the timing, every day, what happened to me, but it's 75 days. Luckily, I written a book about it or
a memoir
about that, everyday details.
But it included torture.
Correct. Tortured. Now, when I say 75 days, it's 75 days of torture. It's not just physically tortured. It's mentally when they say, we brought your sister here, we brought your, you know, as an Iraqi, family is a big, I'm not just saying just Iraqi or Middle Eastern, no. I'm sure everyone here, their family is priority. When they say, we brought your sister, you just break down. And I have nothing. I don't have nothing. I worked for you guys. I gave all the information you needed. And I actually show you where the right way is. I give lectures. I give and on and on and on. The water, the rocks, the mice in my cell, throwing mice or rats or you know, so I started doing a hunger strike. And for several days, because I was, you know, no one is believing on me.
In the documentary, you do get to a point where it clarifies why they detained you. And it had to do with connections, somebody that you knew.
Yes.
But at what point during the 75-day period that they detained you, that they actually told you the reason why they, you know, were holding you?
They never told me why.
They never told
me. No, you. The colonel told me why.
The colonel who
believed on
who believed you and ended up was a part of your release. And
yes.
So, and you know, it's so hard when you interview the filmmakers and the film is going on because the point is for the audience, we want you to go see the film. Mm-hmm. But in this context, in this talk, you know, we'll just go ahead and mention it. But it was your relationship with a cousin who, right? The cousin or the, well, because you mentioned Saddam Hussein in the context of uncle, but I don't think that is Saddam Hussein your uncle.
No.
Yeah.
So I'm from the same tribe. Mm-hmm. We do call him uncle, but he is not my uncle. But yes, it was one of my cousins that he came and threatened me, and he says, you know, my uncle is mad at you. You need to quit with the army or help us. So I went immediately to the intelligence and told them the whole story. And when they track this person with his license, they track Saddam Hussein. They capture Saddam Hussein and then him. And then the story goes on. I don't want to.
So you helped.
Well, in here, that's why I was excited. I don't want to talk
why
about
you were kind of thinking
but I was like, yeah, I'm going to, you know, that's why the story goes there.
I have chills.
Yeah, but this is what's a story that's not in the documentary.
Mm-hmm.
Why? So Colonel Nicholson knows me as I was his translator. I was his right in the back, whatever he needs. I was giving him advices and he was... It was Mother's Day, and he wanted to buy for his mother an Iraqi tea set. The only person can help him find is Tex.
Mm-hmm.
That's how he started searching for me, and that's how it ended up. This is a story. It's not in the documentary, mm-hmm. but it's just a blessing to.
Yeah.
It's just
led to your release. Yes. He went to your home and your mom told him what happened, and yeah. and he made the phone calls and found you and made a deal with the people who captured you. That's in the documentary.
Yeah.
Well, there is one part though that, you know, we didn't want to start the show off by asking you about coming out, because there are two points in the film in which you talk about coming out. And we'll go with the first, or in, you know, we're continuing our conversation about being detained and being tortured. But they questioned you and they were sure of it, that you were hiding something. Mm-hmm. And there was a moment in the film in which you finally tell them what you were hiding, and that was the fact that you are a gay man. You mm-hmm. are a gay man. Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, you know, the response after that.
So, yeah, it's kind of a funny thing to come out to the guy who's interrogating you. But I was telling them everything. They couldn't believe it. I was like, you know, maybe they can tell my face, or maybe they can tell I'm hiding something. So I came out, said, yes, I'm gay. And that time I felt relieved, because you know what? The only thing, one thing that I kept it is out no longer. So I have nothing to hide now, believe me or not. And he looked at me and he smiled and he says, it's okay, I'm American. Hmm. And that's another thing goes, wow, you know, because I never came out to, I mean, part of our culture, if some of you know, as a Middle Eastern, holding hands with another man, it's just normal. Kissing man to man is normal. You hang out with men, you don't hang out with females. In your room, no one knows what's going on. The only thing is they're not going to think something is going on. So it's a part of how our culture, and I never had a problem of being myself. I probably mentioned that in the beginning. I don't label things. What how I've been taught is you are yourself, you know. I'm not, you don't need to say I'm gay. You need to say I'm, you know, bi, or so. Yeah. So I came out, and that was my first time to say a person in front that I am gay.
Wow.
Felt amazing.
Not kind of the conversation that generally ends up with, you know, you're the other guy, you know, joining you at a P-flag march, but. When was that in the 75 days? Was that near the end or near the beginning? Or?
That was, I will say, 60 days. I still have 15 days left.
It's almost a cliche in like movies and cartoons of when someone's in prison, they're counting the days. Were you?
Yeah, I was putting like, you know, those nails,
yeah,
because I didn't have nothing. I don't know. I do ask this. So there's a guard. I'm the only person who had a guard on top of my detention to watch me, because I'm not supposed to talk. It's one of the things. I was in the isolation section. It's called isolation section. I can see all the detainees, you know, walking and socializing and doing whatever they want. I'm the only person who was on that box. Mm-hmm. But there's a guy who I became friend, because at night, you know, you can't basically.
Yeah.
I don't know when I sleep, when I wake up, but I was, you know, having the only conversation. But he told me, you know, we swear not to tell, you know, because don't the commanders, if they see me, I'm going to be in trouble. I was like, it's okay. So I was talking with him, and he was very, very nice person. And he's the second guy that because I was telling him about the, he was asking what did they ask you. So he's the second guy that I told him I'm gay.
Mm. I have so many questions, and you're absolutely right. An hour is just not enough time. No. But I mean, there's two parts to this question. The first part is to kind of get us going in how you got here. But I mean, you were the guy, courageous, believed in something, not a quitter, right? Working with the American military, and then you are tortured and detained mm-hmm. by the very people that you're helping. Mm-hmm. what's going through your mind and your heart and at this point, and kind of like, you know, the will to live, the will to move forward, and to know that you'll get rescued or they'll understand eventually?
Well, I at some point I did collapse and almost give up hope, life, love, believe at some point. But then I always there's something, I don't know what it is, but it's something telling me, no, you know, you better, there is some hope, there is something. And then I got released. Mm-hmm. But inside of me, when I got released, I have no choice because I'm already being wanted by the Iraqis. They wanted my head. So I can't. So I said, no, I don't want to get released. That's basically what I told them. No. They say, you know, you're free. I said, no, I don't want to go out. I have no life. I have no future. I have no career. I have no family. I have nothing. Why do you want to release me? I'm here. So, and then they say, well, Colonel Nicholson is going to keep you working with the army. And I did work for a year and a half. But that year and a half, every day is a nightmare because I'm saying, having, what's going to happen to me? Maybe they're going to put me back. Maybe on. So that is.
So the year and a half, you continued working.
Yes,
and then
serving the army. Yeah. For another year and a half, keep on giving them lectures, keep on pushing them, keep on not putting innocent, which is, I don't blame, it's not easy to know which is the bad guy and which is the good guy because it's a new country. You don't know faces, you don't know what's going on. But yeah.
So how'd you get to the United States?
So when I decided to quit from the army, I told them I need to go back. I need to quit. I can't do it anymore. Yeah. I'm still having nightmares and I'm still... So they took me to the airport and I went to exile, which is, it was Jordan. So in Jordan, I went to the United Nations. The process took forever. Took for 3 years. Mm. 3 years to come here. They told me, what do you choose? So I choose in San Francisco. And now I'm here.
Oh, wow.
I came here in 2008.
Now, you were married. Mm-hmm. And that kind of sets up some
that's another
later
story.
Part of the story. But it also kind of goes to what you're talking about how, you know, being gay, you know, ignore that term. Did you feel a conflict between private and...
So conflict? Let's clarify that I was married to a female.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. It was an arranged marriage because I was a diplomat. I was 31 years old. That's something. What? You're 31 and you're not married. There's something wrong with you. They don't think something wrong with you means like, you know, maybe you're awkward or... No, they think something is not functioning. That's the only thing they think. So it was an arranged marriage. And this is what funny story because you guys are going to remember what I was talking about in the beginning. They gave me pictures and they say, choose. And I said, no, I know that. I know those. And then suddenly I saw this lady. I said, what is that? Mm-hmm. Is she Iraqi? She could go, yeah. I was like, wow. She looks like Barbie. And that's why I married her.
Wow.
She looks exactly like Barbie. And she's 6 foot tall as well. Same Barbie hair, eyes. And I was, believe it or not, putting makeup on her and dressing her up.
Wow. Wow. Gosh, again.
Childhood dream come true.
Yeah. Like we said, there's a lot of layers. Go ahead.
Well, you grew up. Your background, your family is Sunni.
Correct. That's another thing. So her background is Shia, which is previously we didn't have any problem with Shia, Sunni, or Muslim, Christian, or we didn't talk about that. Previously, it's basically talk about your background as Ba'athi or not. You know, Ba'athi is the party of the Saddam Hussein's or not, or you have power, you have money or not.
Yeah.
But when the war collapsed, she was pregnant with my son. Her parents asked for to be separated and divorced, and then life just...
Do you think they suddenly disliked you, or they were thinking of her safety because of the Sunni-Shia split that was kind of erupting all over the country?
It's both. I don't know what to not like about me, but...
Well, I guess it's I had a lot of questions there. Like, you know, at what point did your family, your wife, your ex-wife, and child find... Or you clarified for us even that you never really actually came out to family at all. Like, so, to your, you know, saying, like, I'm a gay man.
I...
Never, right?
No. I never... my ex-wife don't know yet. Mm-hmm. She is married. She have a... two kids from her current husband. Once again, it's not necessary to label myself. Mm-hmm. My son came here finally to visit his dad first time. He was here all August. He wanted to watch the documentary. I told him, you're too young. He's 16, you're too young to watch it. Because it's a lot of dramatic. It's not because it's me being gay or coming out of the documentary. No, no, it's not talking about that. You probably watched it, so it's more dramatic. But there's some fun part.
It would be pretty intense to watch that.
No, for the
that,
first
that's
time.
That's what my dad is going through. Mm-hmm.
So it was a great relation, great travel, great trip here. With him, we're getting closer and closer. He did tell me at one point that, Dad, I know everything about you. So that's a good thing. But yeah. I didn't ask him what is you know about me. But I'm sure he, you know.
There's Google.
I mean, I dress up younger than what he used to dress up. So
well, knows his dad is. Yeah, I mentioned Google because, you know, once you Google
you. If you just Google my, my God.
And aside from the film, right, you started or founder of Ashek,
yes,
a Middle Eastern LGBTQ organization here in the Bay Area. You've marched in San Francisco Pride Parades with Ashek. What else? I mean, that, you know. Oh,
yeah.
Well,
Facebook.
This leading up to the second part of your coming out, that is watching the news and hearing the story.
So when... Erin, which is my director and the lady who filmed me and followed me for 10 years, because that document is made for 10 years. It was a 10-year project. My attention was not coming out on the documentary. The documentary is about a refugee who's trying to survive this country. And at that time, 2008, it was depression. Economy, people not easy to find job. I had a depression because of that, and in trying to survive this city. And then I saw the news, and then I just explode.
The news
six Iraqi gay men were being killed, and not just six. I mean, it was going on and on and on, but that was it. The militias, and suddenly, all of a sudden, I mean, I never heard about a person who, a suicide bomber, for example. I never heard about it before the war. I never heard about a person kills another person because he's gay. I never heard about it. But when everything collapsed in the country, all these just stories happened to pop out. So I saw the news, which is Iraqi gay man being killed in Iraq. I just suddenly exploded. I was like, okay, someone need to step up. Someone need to try to change. One voice, I'm not looking for more than one voice. If I change one voice, that voice is going to change 10. And that 10 will be 1,000 or more, just like you, Michelle.
Oh, wow. I'm going to faint, you know, just from the... I never look at this program that way, but thank you. And, you know, something you said, though, in the documentary when you talked about coming out and being a voice after hearing that news, and then your family members seeing that you're being tagged on Facebook at these gay bars or with other men. And, you know, you mentioned that it was probably harder to you know, be a gay man than what your family felt as traitorous and working for the American government.
It is. It is. If you betrayed or tell a lie or do something wrong, they may disown you, but they will forgive you. Or maybe they will, you know, punish you, but then they will forgive you. But if you're gay, it's not just going to... I mean, they can't change that. So the only thing they can change it is with a bullet. In addition of that, is they're going to bring the shame of the family, the tribe. Your sister may not get married, or, you know, that's how it is over there, complicated.
Mm-hmm. So you, and I, again, it's one of those issues that I don't want to get too much into the film, but through a fair part of this film, you're just trying to contact your son, and you can't. And as you already said, you know, he's been here now and such. So that seems to be moving along nice. Do you have any contact whatsoever with your ex-wife directly?
Well, now, actually, me and my ex are friends.
Really?
Yes, I give her advices, not the makeup advices. I give her advices with her relation with her current husband. I gave her advices for my son because he's getting a teenager. It's hard to, you know, control a teenager. Yeah, so we are friends now. That's a good thing. I'm in contact with my mom, my mother, my son, FaceTime. It's a blessing. All my life in the documentary and the end, what it tell you, it happened. My career, my relation, but I'm still single. That's the only thing.
that's part two of the documentary. Exploring, dating in San Francisco as a gay man. But you know what's remarkable is that we find out you maintained a virtual relationship with your son. I think, you know, how many years? What?
So he is now 16. I met him when he was 4 years old in Jordan. It was his birthday. And then that's all it's time that she let me see my own son. It was very hard. And then I came here. I've been here for 10 years. And then 3 years ago, in the documentary, I'm trying. I'm just trying, you know, contact, mail something. And I finally got a chance because I only have her. He was still young to have his own phone. And then finally, I got the chance to hear him. And... it's a blessing. Now we're buddies. And
so many stories. So many stories. You know, we're up near the moment in which we ask from our audience if you have any questions. But I have one question before we get there. And that is, you know, something that what I find to also be inspiration and draw from you is once you got here to the United States, it was told to you or understood that there was a program that the government had implemented to ensure safety for folks like yourself who helped the American government, the military during the war. I think in the documentary it stated like 100,000 Iraqis had supported the American military, and a lot of them tragically have been killed and still awaiting, you know, that moment in which there is safety. For you, you got here thinking that there was a clear path, and it didn't end up that way, actually. You had to get creative. You had to have a lot of patience, and it was actually much more years later that you were able to get a green card, become a citizen of the United States.
Yeah, I mean, I'm the lucky one. Now it's really hard. It's much more difficult. the whole process. But when I came here, I came through an organization called IRC, International Rescue Committee. And they were trying to do their best. But, you know, remember, if they don't have a financial support, they barely can do, you know, their real job. But I was first moved in Auckland, a place with other roommates, which I'm not used to have that. But, hey, you know, everyone here in San Francisco have roommates right now. And then they tried to help me get a job, but it was not easy. So I took my own way how to find a job. And I was lucky once again to start that, you know, path. Mm-hmm. My first, I went to the, believe it or not, I was walking all San Francisco, and I went to the LGBTQ center. Mm-hmm. And I just went in. I gave up hope. I was walking all San Francisco with my resume and putting my resume because that's what they told me to do. I never done it. And I was like, you know what? That's it. Either here or just you know, I was almost giving up. And I went there and they contact Project Open Hand. Mm. And that was open, not hand, open heart, open door for the whole life of right now who I am. It was my school to not just introduce who the people. I've got so many friends. I know the culture, are the American, how they eat. Mm. You know, for me, it's very important. It took me only 3 years over there to be the production manager, the catering chef. And then from there, rest is history.
And I want to talk a bit about the whole chef career because you've become quite a bit of a success at it.
Thanks.
But before that happened, mm-hmm. had you considered yourself a good cook? Or was this an interest? Did you see yourself doing this at some point?
No, it's always my passion. Okay. But back in Iraq, I'm not allowed to cook as a man.
Really?
Because of my background. I'm a diplomat. My grandfather used to be the minister of defense. My father is an ambassador, blah, 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 on and on. You know, the whole family, my uncles, everyone is big in the previous regime. So I'm not allowed to do what I love. I'm allowed to do what they want.
We didn't even get into Food Network, but you'll have to see the film to know, you know, the Food Network part, okay? Yeah. We gave you all the big stuff.
Yeah.
Well, let's open up questions from the audience. If you've got a question for G, we'll take them. And this is a recording, so speak into the mic.
Yeah. Just first question, how can we see the documentary?
Yeah, it's good.
Yes, that's a great question.
Screening anywhere? Is it streaming on the internet?
Yes. Well, just 1 second. Let me pull it out. It's right here. So the upcoming screening, you have several ones of them. The Mel Valley Film Festival, Saturday, October 13th. Mel Valley Film Festival, October 14th, that's Sunday. And then in San Francisco, we have the Arab Film Festival. This is very interesting. The Arab Film Festival is putting a gay documentary, which is, I'm just blown away about that. So this one is on October 17th at the Roxy Theater. And then in Oakland, October 19th in the Parkway, Oakland Parkway Theater. The new Parkway.
What's the title?
From Baghdad to the Bay.
Mm. Yeah.
What's your other question?
General question about living in some of these countries where being gay is very difficult.
Mm-hmm.
Heard some criticism recently of people from outside, activists trying to help change things, and maybe some of the things they're doing are not productive. Do you think things are changing? Is there anything that outsiders could help with?
Yeah, I am familiar with so many activists in the Middle East. They're trying to change. change don't come immediately. It takes time. It takes more patience. We have to be patient. Sacrifice, a lot of sacrifice from the LGBTQ community. We have a lot of them just sacrifice their life for others. So it exists. It's once again, it's very hard to give them funds. You know, people are generous, especially in this lovely city. They're generous, trying to donate as much as they can, but still it's not easy. But yeah, they exist. Thank you.
So what are you starting a new chapter in your professional career. Why don't you give us a taste of that?
Yes, I am starting October 1st. I'm the executive chef for California Academy of Science Museum.
Wow. Congratulations. That is so awesome. Did you have a question?
Wanted to know, does your son and ex-wife live in Iraq now?
No, that's a good question because we did not mention that. They live in United Kingdom. Yeah, thank you for asking that question.
And has your son ever either gone to, because he's never been in Iraq, right?
He's been there a long time. Yeah, okay. With his mom. No, they travel.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. That moment he landed at SFO, you picked him up.
Yeah.
You made contact. What was that like?
First he came, and it's my first time to see him, and he wanted to jump on me. And I said, wait, I have a bad back. He was bigger than me. So he's 6'1".
Whoa.
He's 16, yeah. He was bigger than me.
Barbies are tall.
He is, he's taller than me. So it was just... I thought I'm going to have a lot of, I was just speechless, just shocked and just hugging him. Because I cried a lot, I didn't cry. I was just like, okay, this is a new chapter. Because every day when you wake up, it's a new chapter for your life. That's what I think about it. That's my perspective. So every day is a new story for me. That was a new chapter for me. And it was just unbelievable. 40 days he spent here. We traveled.
It was unbelievable. That it was just last month. I mean, just in August.
Yes.
And what did he love about San Francisco? What do you think about the city?
He loved it because he thinks the people are friendly. They are. They're very friendly.
Yeah.
He loved it. He says the people are very friendly. He loved America a lot. He says our character is different than the British. Sorry, British. And then the other thing, he loved the weather, mm-hmm. of course. Oh, you know, he lives in Manchester, so it's too...
Yeah, coming from England, the one place where you think San Francisco is sunny.
Yeah, and he never hiked. First time he hiked with his dad, which is amazing. And we hiked Oakland, Redwood Hills. We went up from where I live, which is Civic Center, up to Twin Peaks. Mm-hmm. We walked from where I live to the Ocean Beach and coming back. Yeah, he was dropping a lot of weight, that's for sure. And yeah, it was amazing. First time to have his lobster, I made him a lobster. First time he had a medium rare steak, I made him that. So it was just amazing.
Wow. Well, gee, you know, I can't even find the right words to articulate like just how meaningful and special you are to our movement, to this country, to our people, and not just from like the LGBTQ community, but everything from the moment that you decided what you believed in, you went for it, you stayed the course in that job, even if you became the enemy, and in two different parts of your life, your family, and knowing that that was obviously a very important system in, you know, the human connection, right? It's family and then your career, your friends. But you never gave up. You never gave up, even if you wanted to, and if you felt like it. And here you are, in the country that treated you like you were a traitor, just doing what I think is the magical thing about America, the virtue of opportunity and freedom. I would love to hear from you, kind of Yeah, like what if people are, especially now, and this is not, it's not a political question, it's not politically charged, but everybody tries to define what is American. And unfortunately, with that kind of question comes folks who might have a perspective that's very exclusive or linear or nationalistic, which can lead to problems of oppression like racism and things like that. Mm-hmm. But for someone like you who went through everything that you did and still here today celebrating the fact that you'll be the new head chef at Cal Academy of Science, providing, creating space for LGBTQ Middle Eastern community. You know, what does all that mean to you? And if you were to tell somebody like what it actually means to be American, like what would that be?
Well, first of all, thank you. Every person here has his own story. And every story is different. And mine just is different. I believe in dedication. I believe in be truthful with yourself. Things happened for a reason. That's what I believe. I don't say America or Americans. I say individuals who done that to me. I'm going to blame the procedure or the system, but the person who was doing that, that's his job, like me being a mean chef. I don't mean to be mean, but this is my job. I need my work to be perfect. So it's a blessing to live the American dream, because as you just mentioned, Michelle, I have a great job that is one of my dreams. I have another thing, which is Ishq for the Middle East, North African, LGBTQ, bring them together. I live in the most amazing city I can ever imagine. And I have a new family, which is my friends. And I'm just being grateful. It's just a blessing. I have no words, really. But I only have one thing to say is go and watch the documentary. It's a changing of,
it is very powerful.
Your perspective. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
She actually asked the question I had been like waiting to ask, but
oh, I'm sorry. Our minds are starting to think alike. I'll be the gay guy and you could be the lesbian. We'll switch off every now and then.
But going through what you went through and you know, so you're then in Jordan. Were you in a refugee camp or were you in the...
No, I was there as... first, I was there just trying to see what can I do, because I have no career. Once again, nothing. Just went there to try to do or survive.
Survive, yeah.
So I went to the United Nations. It's not easy in Jordan as an Iraqi at that time. I don't know what's the process right now. But to work... You're not allowed to work, and it was expensive. So the United Nations only gave me a card that it says, he's okay, don't deport him. That's the only thing for 3 years I had. But I was working under the table, as they say here, as a catering for cooking, so as a chef.
Now, under the table has a different meaning as well. Am I
yes.
Right?
It's like, what do you call it? In the closet.
In the closet.
Under the table.
We're going to try to popularize
a lot of furniture here.
When you were in Jordan, did you, I mean, were you kind of thinking, I could go any, you know, other countries?
No,
I mean,
it was
you could
a
have
big
gone
jail.
To Sweden and all the women in Sweden look like Barbie. I mean,
yeah,
isn't that at all kind of...
No.
Or was it always, if I leave here, I want to go to the United States?
No, it was my destiny to that separation between or divorce between me and my ex. It was like, yes, I'm back. So it's a destiny. Everything happened from my birth, believe it or not. And I put that on the book since the birth, how I lost my hearing, how I had a seizure, how it's a lot. Every day I'll tell you a story, believe me. So everything is destiny. It's written for me. So I'm, yeah. So in Jordan, no, it was a big jail. I'm there. I can walk. I can talk, but I'm not allowed to work. I'm not allowed to travel. I'm not allowed. So I was just living.
And talk about. Something was written. You said earlier you had written this up as a book at some point. Are you still looking to publish that at some point?
Yes, but I'm not good at editing. Editing needs a person who can put words in.
Yeah, that's what your publisher does.
Yeah. So yeah, no, absolutely. It's the title is not nice to read it, but this is it. This is my title.
We'll find you an editor.
Yeah.
We have just a couple minutes left. And again, if you have a question you would like to ask G, we'll open it up. But if not, I will take the last question.
It's probably mine anyway.
Well, the film is called From Baghdad to the Bay, and it is a documentary on the life of Ghazwan al-Sharif, we're calling G, and that's what he goes by, and you just heard the screenings here locally, but please go out and see the film. I know what I took from the film, and I know John knows what he took from the film. We mentioned it many times throughout this hour of it being an inspiration. And the story is about you, but I think that its purpose and how this documentary came together and all of it, you have a purpose for sharing your story. What would you like for those folks who go out to see your film, what would you like for them to take from watching the film?
Just don't give up hope. That's the whole subject. If you give up hope, then no reason of watching that documentary. Yeah.
Wow. Well, G, thank you so much for joining us here on the Michelle Miao Show.
Thank you for having me. It's been a wonderful 1 hour.
Yeah, I can't believe it. And the documentary is only a little over an hour, and you won't believe it. I had to watch it.
And when you're watching
times.
It, watch through the credits. There's an end segment that is priceless. It's almost as good as like the Marvel movie end segment.
It's good. Yeah.
The Michelle Miao Show airs on the Progressive Voices Network. Daily, 4 o'clock Pacific Standard Time. We're here every Thursday at the Commonwealth Club at noon. Next week, we have a great guest, Lynn Keezer. She's with Ford as one of the first transgender employees to transition while on the job. And she's got a great story about one of the senior executives and their support of her transition. So if you can make it, join us. We'll provide lunch. We'll see you next time. Thanks for joining us for the Michelle Miao Show, your A through Z covering the LGBT, LMNOP, and everyone in between. We're here every Thursday live at the Commonwealth Club, and you can listen to past shows at
commonwealthclub.org/MMS.